Hello. The law on the Isle of Man with regard to organ donation will be changing from the beginning of 2026, from the current opt-in system to an opt-out system. This podcast aims to clarify just what this means for Isle of Man residents. And as we mark Organ Donation Week, which started on the 22nd of September, several key players involved with organ donation on the island discuss the whole topic of donating your organs after death and what this means for both donors, donors' families, and of course recipients. It's hosted by me, Howard Kane.
My name's Pam Makin. I'm matron for critical care at Nobles Hospital, and I'm also the chair of the organ donation on the Isle of Man.
Hi, my name is Nikki Leslie. I'm a heart recipient and I am on the layperson on the organ donation committee in Nobles.
Hi, I'm Diane Taylor and I'm an organ donor mum and founder of Organ Donation Isle of Man.
Hi, I'm Di Parker. I'm the Good Grief Coach and I'm on a mission to help people understand a lot more about grief as an emotion. And this is a subject that's very close to my heart, so I'm glad to be here.
Hi, I'm Matt Tyra and I'm Director of Public Health for the Isle of Man Government.
The law on the Isle of Man as it stands at the moment, I was just earlier on chatting and looking at my slightly battered and ancient donor card now, as a kidney donor card as it was at the time. Where are we now when it comes to organ donation?
So Tynwald has recently approved a change to the way that we do organ donation on the Isle of Man. So although the bill got royal assent back in 2021, we're now actually enacting that. So from the 1st of January 2026 on the Isle of Man, we will be moving from an opt-in system of organ donation to an opt-out system. And the change essentially means that from January, adults who are over 18 and haven't opted out of being an organ donor and aren't part of an excluded group will be presumed to consent to organ donation upon their death.
What sort of drove this decision?
So there are a range of things. In part, this brings us into line with other jurisdictions in the United Kingdom. So it brings us in line with England, Wales, Scotland, and then also Guernsey and Northern Ireland, who were the most recent to introduce this kind of approach. So this is the result of strong campaigning from Diane and Organ Donation Isle of Man in collaboration with the creation of a private members bill, which was brought before Tynwald. That's the bill that gained royal assent in 2021. And that's what we've been enacting through public health ever since. The new system will come in 2026, and that will bring us in line with other jurisdictions that have implemented this. So Wales brought it in 2018, Jersey and Scotland brought it in 2019, England brought it in 2020, and Guernsey and Northern Ireland brought it in 2023. And it's really important to just add to that that alongside those jurisdictions, families will always be consulted before any donation proceeds. And that does mean that it's really important that people do take the time to register their decision. So there is an opportunity both to opt out and to continue to opt in alongside this. So one of the things that I think is just really important to highlight is that as of July 2025, there are 59,034 people on the Isle of Man who have recorded their decision, with 58,000 of those registered as opt-in and 980 of those registered as opt-out. So in general, the vast majority of people are very supportive of opting in to donate their organs. So moving to a system of opt-out makes a lot of sense for our population.
So it is a sort of a degree then of presumed consent then come 2026 that unless you're specifically said otherwise, it is presumed you've given consent for your organs to be donated on your death.
Yes, that's right. And for most people, that would be a decision that they would wish to make. But for those who do feel strongly, there remains the opportunity to make a choice and register their decision in either direction with the NHS Blood and Transplant Register.
So if anyone's sort of listening and thinking, right, I mean, there's already good responses you've said there. If people are listening and they feel, yes, they do want to actually register, where would they go if they wanted to say, you know what, I've thought about it, I've read about it, and I don't want to donate my organs? They would go, what, to a specific website?
Yeah, the website is organdonation.nhs.uk, or you can actually phone the organ donor helpline, which is 0300 123 2323.
And Matt was saying there, Diane, there was a lot of campaigning to actually drive forward for this. Why did you feel so strongly about it yourself?
Well, 18 and a half years ago, at the worst time of my life, I was being told that my 15-year-old son had passed away, and it was only the machines keeping him alive. And it was then his dad and I were asked about organ donation. Up until that point, although obviously you're aware of it, it wasn't a subject that anyone talked about. I'd certainly never heard it on the Isle of Man. My mum was a senior nurse at the hospital all her years, all the time I was growing up, and yet it hadn't ever come up in conversation. And obviously having to make a decision like that, being asked to donate your 15-year-old's organs after being told he passed away, was just, I can't even, explain it. Luckily for his dad and I, it was an easy decision. But, a couple of years after that, I wanted to know more, and, I felt that I wasn't going to be the only person or the only family that found ourselves in that position, and that if we'd have had the conversation as a family before, then it would be a lot easier to have known what Daniel wanted, and know 100% it was his choice. So I started thinking, how can we get this out on the Isle of Man and get people just thinking about it, themselves? Nobody ever wants to think it's going to ever happen to them. And, we were one of those families, you just do not think that you were going to ever find yourself in that position. So I started off with just a small Facebook page. It wasn't, it was before Organ Donation Isle of Man. That was in about 2011. I still had more questions about after we lost Daniel, and I got in touch with NHSBT, who organised for me to meet with Daniel's specialist nurse. Daniel actually passed away in Pendlebury Children's Hospital, and his specialist nurse came over with Abby, who was our specialist nurse for the Isle of Man, and I met with them about 3 or 4 hours and went, I just asked all of those questions, and I just felt we had to start, doing something, and Facebook was the obvious. Quite quickly the page grew, and I then opened Organ Donation Isle of Man, and I joined the committee at Nobles. And right from day one, for the reason I did it, was so that people think about it and make their own choice, so that they don't have to make it after being told that someone they love has passed away. And I also started seeing the other side of it and the recipients, and just how amazing organ donation is. And I have no doubt that Daniel could not be saved. I watched his dad, and I watched them doing work on him for nearly 24 hours, from Nobles Hospital to being in Pendlebury. We were shown scans, we watched them being heated up, we watched them being cooled down. So when Daniel was, we were told that it was only the machines keeping him alive, and we had no doubt that he had gone. We also watched 2 sets of brainstem tests, which, if you have any doubt that somebody was still in there, then they prove, that they have gone. And it was, a 15-year-old healthy lad. What a waste it would have been if we had been so scared at that point and said no. So, now Daniel is gone from our life, but he's living on in other people's lives, meaning that their lives have carried on, and there's been, a dad that could walk his daughter down the aisle, a granddad that could bounce his grandchild on his knee, and it's just amazing. I'll never get over not having Daniel with us. That it's just it's too big to even try and explain what it feels like not having him, but the comfort knowing that he's still out there, part of him is still out there. And
I was going to say, and that's something you do feel. You feel that still.
Yeah. Because there's some days, and I, especially, you know, with everything that's gone on through since it gained royal assent, and, you know, I wish I could tell them. But I know somebody out there, they won't know they've got Daniel's, they won't associate, you know, Daniel with themselves, but they'll see, you know, that the Isle of Man is now going to help other people. So he's still, somebody somewhere is going to be thinking about him and what their gift, you know, every day. And it's not just, you know, his family. So it's immense.
And I think it is, I mean, in awe of your altruistic nature, because I think it's, as you say, an incredibly traumatic time for yourselves, having the clearness of thought. And as you've been describing there, I think it's, as you say, no one thinks it's going to happen to them. And very sadly, it did happen to you, and you have to make this very difficult decision at that time. When you say you got out on Facebook originally, what sort of initial response did you get when you floated it?
When it first started, well, the page grew quite quickly. You know, people were liking the page. And at that point, I was just sharing posts from NHSBT off their Facebook page. But it became, it sort of, in those first sort of, I think I only had that page for about 3 or 4 months, because then I could see that it was growing. And people were contacting me too, because they'd had a transplant or they'd lost someone. And it was around that time that I joined the committee, and the idea of the memorial garden was put out. And the more the page grew, the more people, the interest grew. And, you know, people, it's more so now, you know, that at least once a day somebody will mention it to me, but people wanted to know more. So then as I got to know more people, we were able to share Isle of Man stories. And of course, then people thought that you couldn't donate your organs on the Isle of Man. Well, obviously, at that point, I couldn't comment because Daniel had to be flown to the UK. But then people from over here were contacting me. And as the fundraising for the garden went on, more people contacted me. And I think when we opened the memorial garden, we had 15 donor stones go in for Isle of Man residents, going back to, I think it was it was in the 1980s, the sort of the first one that, you know, asked for the stones. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Daniel wasn't the only one. There was a lot of people. So the page grew and people's interest grew. And I have to be honest, in the last 13 years that I've been doing this, I've not had one person that has acted, you know, sort of in any really bad negative way. I've been doing sort of stands, and I've had a couple of people come up and say they, you know, they don't agree with it, but can we have a pen anyway? You know, but they're not offensive or anything. But the only thing I could say, you know, for people that aren't sort of for it, a lot of it is people don't know, they don't think they're going to be saved. That's one I get a lot. They don't think it can happen here. So the certainly the last sort of 5 or 6 years, you know, we've gone out, haven't we, and we've done so many talks to student nurses out in WI, and people are very, you know, they want to ask questions. Mm. They want to know more. And it takes away that sort of the unknown and the scariness of it, because I can totally understand that if it hadn't have been Daniel and we watched everything that they did, then, you know, some people's fears that I can understand. But by telling my personal story, I can sort of cross off some of those fears. You know, I watched Daniel and trying to save him. I watched the way that he was treated, you know, and he was unconscious from the scene, and yet from the scene to Nobles to Pendlebury, all the time the doctors and nurses are talking to him and telling them what they're doing, and you know, encouraging his dad and I to touch him, because it's scary. But it's wrong. It's hard to explain, because it's hard to say we had a positive experience, but we haven't got anything that we look back on and think that was horrendous. I wish, you know, that hadn't happened. And especially when I do talks with the student nurses, I say to them, we were told to, you know, touch Daniel and talk to him. And that is, you know, so important, because you're scared, he's covered in wires. But the more talks we do, we can help people that do have any worries or doubts, and we can talk to them, you know, about after he's passed away, what happens. So, you know, from starting the page and being able to share my story, other local people that have, you know, come along, then it's just grown, and people do want to know. Mm. And, you know, when you think you're going to save somebody's life, then it's massive.
Nikki Leslie, I mean, as a transplant recipient, I mean, how do you sort of feel when you hear Diane tell her story?
I always think Diane's story is completely, I don't know, it's really emotional, it's really inspirational. What they did was phenomenal. And as Di says, mostly in these talks when we do them, is, you know, Daniel was such a giving person that she had no doubt, her and her ex-husband had no doubt in their minds that he would have, had you asked him, he'd have said, yes, take it all, you know?
Definitely.
And so, again, it's kind of going back to the conversation, having the conversation and knowing. But yeah, it's, I do find, even now, you to be very inspirational, even though we've done this a lot, because, you know, in the hardest times, you get asked the hardest questions. You know, there's nothing easy. I mean, I know I sort of said it was easy for them to make the decision, but it wasn't, not in reality, when you put it down to black and white.
No, I think that's the whole thing, isn't it? I think it's, as you saying it sounds easy, but the actual decision itself is, I think for people who haven't experienced it, it's very difficult to imagine what it must be like.
For sure.
I think I say, well, you know, an easy decision. You know, his dad and I just looked at each other and we knew what Daniel, you know, we just wanted to help people. Yeah. So to unite and make that decision was easy. But I can only imagine if one of us had said no and the other had said yes, you know, what that would be. So, and there's going to be a lot of people, you know, like that, unless they've made that decision first.
And so knowing Daniel would definitely think this is what I would want to happen, it helped both of you at the time, obviously.
Well, we think sort of 99.9% sure that he would have done. You know, he was due to have signed up for his provisional, so the next month. So at that point, when it was on the driving licence, he would have made that decision.
For you then, Nikki, receiving an organ yourself, and I know someone said to me, sort of saying, I wonder what it feels like to actually receive an organ. I mean, it sounds like a daft question, but what does it feel like?
It's not a daft question at all. It's weird. It's probably the only way you can say, I'm alive because I've got somebody else's heart. You know, and when I think about it, it blows my mind. Completely blows my mind. You know, I'm part granddad now. I didn't even have kids. How can I be part granddad? You know. So when I think about it, I find it very strange. I get quite emotional about it. I was really lucky. I wasn't on a transplant list for very long. I say I was lucky. I was just the sickest person that day when the heart became available. But I was only on the transplant list for about 4 or 5 days. So I was very lucky and I got my heart very quickly. So it meant I didn't have that long waiting period of when, you know, your head can really get messed up because, you know, you're sitting there. I mean, especially for something like a heart, you're waiting for somebody to die. And it very much is a matter of how you look at it, because I had terrible guilt post-transplant for that reason alone, that somebody had to die. So I got, you know, a heart to be able to carry on with life. But it's kind of, you've got to flip your thinking, and it's, you've got to kind of flip it into thinking, well, that person was going to pass away anyway. And you were just lucky enough to be within, because at the time you had to be within 4 hours of where the heart was retrieved from. So I was the sickest person in the right vicinity at the time.
And it's an interesting point, I suppose. A lot of people might not think about, as you say, that feeling of guilt, of sort of thinking, I'm going to live because someone else has died.
Yeah, very much so. Mm. I mean, I was very lucky. I have been in contact with my donor's wife. And they actually do have connections back to the Isle of Man. She was delighted his heart's over here. And part of his ashes are actually on the course, on the TT course. But yeah, to begin with, the guilt was pretty crushing. But once, I spoke to, there's transplant psychologists, etc. I spoke to one of those and, you know, as I say, they flipped my thinking. Because the guilt was horrendous.
And then the process itself, is it, I won't ask you to talk through the whole thing, but is it a lengthy, difficult way to sort of have your road back to life again?
Well, it is, because it's not easy to get on the transplant list. It's not a matter of, you know, your doctor tells you you need a transplant, you're going on the list. You have to be medically cleared for everything. So if they can scan it, if they can take bloods from it or liquids from it or anything, you get checked from head to toe, because especially with heart, there's only about 200 heart transplants per year. So they don't want to waste a healthy organ on somebody that has underlying illnesses that aren't going to be able to live on with it. So you have to go through a whole process. And for myself, the medications that were keeping me alive were also destroying my kidneys. But that meant I had to work on getting my kidney function up before they were well enough for me to be able to have the heart and be put on the transplant list. So it's kind of, it's quite difficult to actually get onto the list. And once you're on, you know, you won't necessarily stay on there. So if I'd got a cold, I'd have to come off the list. Because again, they can't give you immunosuppressants whilst you're ill, because it will just make you even worse. So things like that, you know, it's hard work getting there. I was very lucky, as I say, it was only like 4 or 5 days before my heart became available. And I was even luckier because mine was a textbook operation, 4 hours end to end to get the old heart out and the new one in. And then woke up, from when they put me to sleep to when they woke up, it was 34 hours. You have never seen as many tubes as I had attached to me. I mean, I was in intensive care and it scared me. I had tubes coming out of my neck and my arms and everything. It was really weird. And drains, about 3 or 4 drains to stop me sort of overdoing a flip with the liquids. So it's all very scary and it's all kind of surreal, because you kind of know you're going through it, but your brain's not really connecting to it. Because I think if it did, it would literally just blow your mind. I know a lot of my fellow recipients, you know, suffer from PTSD, things like that, from having, because it is such a shock. It's, you know, you are literally dying to get a heart. There is no two ways about it. You have to be an inpatient these days before you're likely to get one. You have to be, you know, within probably 4 or 5 months of, you know, a life expectancy before you will get a heart these days. And so it's, you know, it's very traumatic. And then it's all, once a heart becomes available, it's all of a sudden, there's all this stuff you've got to do. You've got to start taking these, we've got to take this, we've got to do that, you know, and sort of getting ready for the operation is even quite weird. And then post-transplant, you have, I always explain it as like a post-transplant euphoria. Because for about 3 or 4 months, there's nothing you could have done that would have put me in a bad mood. Nothing at all. You know, because it was I didn't mean that close to death. And then sort of suddenly not. It was like, you know, you were on drugs. It was, you know, I was always smiling. I was, you know, there was never, doesn't matter what you did, you would never have put me in a bad mood or upset me. It was very strange.
This
real juxtaposition of death and life, mm. you know, virtually hand in hand, and could easily sort of go either way. Were you aware as soon as you came round that, oh, I'm still alive?
Yeah, very much so, because my sisters were there telling me. poking me awake. yeah, no, it took... I mean, obviously, I was very, very high. Mm. I mean, they did I don't tell people this one very often. They did an echo on my heart, mm. and this is how bad the drugs were. I thought they'd put monkeys in my chest, and if I said anything, they'd take them out and I'd die. That's that's how good the medication was at the time. So kind of it took a few days for all that to wear off. But once that had worn off, you suddenly become very aware. I managed to, one of my complications post-transplant was I lost all my motor skills. So I had to then learn to walk. So I was so busy learning to walk again that I then got something called drop foot, which meant my feet wouldn't work. So I then had to sort of start losing that again. So it took a little while. It took probably about 2 or 3 weeks for me to actually be back into a normal rhythm. And then it was just off you go. Come back every 6 weeks and we'll just do a quick biopsy for the first 2 years. And now I just go back every 6 months, have a checkup, they have a look at it, make sure everything's okay, and then send me home again.
So. And is there ever a day now then when you're, as you say, here you are smiling, chatting away up in the studio, and is there ever a day goes by when you forget about the transplant or you don't think about it, or is it always there in your mind?
It's always there in my mind because I have to take medications every 12 hours. So it's kind of never away because, you know, the immunosuppressants, which keep me alive now. Mm-hmm. They're on a 12-hour rotation. So, you know, I'm always conscious of it. And also there's a great big scar down my chest as well.
Of course.
which reminds you on a daily basis. But yeah, and I think it is something that I should be conscious of because, you know, somebody gave me this gift and I should be conscious of it and I should be grateful for it. This isn't, you know, you don't just go out and buy a new heart. You know, it's not like, you know, you're sort of, you see on American television where Mr. Smith has got more money than Mr. Jones, so Mr. Smith gets a heart. It's not like that. You know, so... So I do think you should be very grateful for any transplant.
And as we're heading towards the opt-out law coming in next year in 2026, there will be, and I'm sure that there might well be people who are thinking, oh, I don't know, maybe I do want to opt out. What would you say to someone who's sort of wavering about the idea of whether they would feel happy about donating organs after their death?
My first question is always, does anybody that says, because I believe everybody has a choice. You know, just because I've had a transplant doesn't mean I'm going to force you to, you know. Mm. So I would always ask, would you accept an organ? If somebody turned around to me and said, oh, no. In fact, one of my friend's husbands, completely against it. And I just thought, well, would you accept an organ? And that person says no. Well, then that's fine. I've no issue with that. But if they sort of say, well, yes. So, well, why wouldn't you, when you've no further need for them, why would you not... then pass them on. Mm. And, you know, as I say, everybody has their own decision to make and everyone has their own conversations to have. But it is ultimately up to you. And it is, you know, something that you need to think about because you are more likely to need an organ than to actually die in circumstances where you can actually donate. So I think that's quite an important message.
And Pam, just sitting next to you there, I mean, we're talking here about organ donation and the change out law, and it's something which, yeah, I mean, everyone's very familiar with the idea of organ donation now, one way or another. I suppose it's been around for a time. We're making this change here on the Isle of Man to the opt-out law, but, I mean, you're someone who's at the cliff face, if I can put it that way. I suppose, you know, we all talk about it, but very few have an understanding of the actual practicality involved in organ donation. You don't know whether you're going to be on a list, you might be on a waiting list, you might be very lucky, you might not. How do people feel about it when they actually come in, when you sort of come into play, is it, when you see them?
I think it's very important to express that we would do everything in intensive care to save a life. That's really important to get that message across, is that we're not there to take the organs, we're there to save a life. And it's only when the time comes, when it's futile, when the patient is not going to survive, then we will discuss about withdrawing care, discuss organ donation. And that's the time when we would actually get in touch with our specialist nurses from organ donation in the Northwest. We have one that visits the island every month, Abby Roberts. Abby's been coming to us for over 10 years, and we would get in touch with specialists for organ donation to say that we might have somebody who may be suitable for organ donor, to be an organ donor. So they would actually check the register first to see if that person has expressed their wishes to be a donor. And then they would actually fly over to the Isle of Man, and they would look at the patient to see whether the patient is suitable to be a donor. So, because we there's lots of investigations, things like that. And they would then speak to the family and speak to family about consent to see, it makes the conversation easier if we know the patient's wishes, because then we can speak to the family and discuss, you know, they were on the register, the wishes were to be an organ donor. How do you feel about this? We're at this stage where that's where we are when we're withdrawing treatment. If it's somebody who is going to have brainstem testing, then we would actually do the brainstem test, speak to family, explain to them we're going to do the brainstem testing, then do the brainstem testing, then speak to the family and talk to them about organ donation after the first set of brainstem tests. And then we would do a second set of brainstem tests. And the family, as Di said, can be present at that time. And I think when they're present and they see that the patient isn't breathing, because you've got to remember, when patients are in intensive care on a ventilator, on a breathing machine, and they're on a monitor, the heart is still beating, they're still warm to touch. It's hard for relatives to think that they're no longer alive, and it's the machines that's keeping them alive. So when we do the brainstem test, one of the tests we do is we take them off the breathing machine, we will watch the chest, we will oxygenate them, but we'll watch the chest to see, do they breathe for 5 minutes, you know, and that's one of the tests that we do. But there's a whole list of tests that we need to do to legally say that somebody is no longer alive. So we're actually part of the NHS BT. We follow their standards on the Isle of Man like anywhere else in the UK and probably worldwide. So the specialist nurse for organ donation has spoken to the family, they have time to think about this, whether they want the organs to be taken or not. And if they say yes, there is a period of time, because we'll need to do blood tests, things like that. And we might have to do chest x-rays, might have to do an echocardiogram, a scan of the heart, things like that. So, and while that is happening, the specialist nurse for organ donation is looking at the register, looking to see which patients are suitable for the transplants elsewhere, you know, waiting for those. So it's actually, as Nikki said, depending where the patients are on the transplant list, where they're waiting, you know, who is most urgent for that organ. And once they know what's happening, we actually have retrieval teams that fly into the Isle of Man. The patient is taken to theatre, and it's like a normal organ operation, and everything is really respected. They take great care to take those organs, because they're going to be transplanted into someone else, and the retrieval team will take the organs off island to be transplanted. It could mean that one of our own Isle of Man residents is called to for a transplant. It could be, if it's a kidney, they normally go to Liverpool. If it's a liver, they might go to Birmingham. Or if it's heart, it could be over to Withenshaw in Manchester. So one of our own Isle of Man residents might be called at the same time that we are actually taking the organs. We don't know. Mm. No one knows, because obviously that is actually very confidential. And then once the organs have been taken, the patient quite often comes back to the intensive care unit where the family can stay with the patient. Family can stay with the patient for as long as they like before the patient goes down to the mortuary. And then we have a bereavement team in the mortuary which will support the family. And then our specialist nurse for organ donation, as I said, she returns to the island in a month's time. She normally makes contact with the family to see whether they'd like them to go out and visit them in case there's any questions, any support. They give them contact numbers and that. We do give bereavement books and things like that to support them as well, the family. But I think the decision for the family is a very brave one to make, because at that time they are grieving as well. And it's, you know, I think what they're doing is giving the gift of life to others is so, so brave of them to be thinking of others at the time where I think that their life has been devastated by the loss of their loved one. And the staff within the intensive unit are supporting the family. They're there. We mainly just listen to the family, listen to and to what they would like, and we follow their wishes.
And that's very important to hearing you say that, I think, because it is, and again, you're right in the thick of it there, and that this is a very emotional time. On the one hand, as a clinical professional, things are done clinically. There is a checklist. Everything is very logical. Then you're dealing with people's lives and deaths and, you know, and organs and all the emotions involved in bereavement and death. And they're not always sort of logical. People react very differently and it's very difficult. We get a feeling of how it goes there, but is it difficult dealing with those two sides concurrently, as it were?
It is difficult because you might actually, at the time where you're dealing with somebody who you actually doing the tests and everything for them to be an organ donor, preparing them for theatre, and you might actually at the same time get an emergency into the intensive care unit. So you're saving a life there, you're protecting the patient who's going into theatre. We normally take patients to theatre for organ donation out of hours because the theatres are running all day. So normally it's in the evening or it might be early hours in the morning, things like that. But we're still carrying on with every day, you know, workload. So you've lots of emotions going on with the families, with other patients seeing what's going on, even with staff, their feelings and things. So you're supporting staff as well as families in circumstances like this.
And just to clear an old chestnut up, I think, which you I think did talk about at the beginning of this, and one I mentioned just before we started recording, and that I've had a kidney donor card in my wallet since I was, I think, 17 years old. And when originally I took it from school, when they were having a drive then, a recruitment drive, and being under 18, I needed to get my parents to sign it, and my mum wouldn't sign it at the time because she was very concerned. She looked at it and we discussed it, and she had this worry, which I'm sure she won't have been alone, that no, I'm not going to sign it, because what happens if you were involved in an accident and were critically injured but were still alive, and then someone far more important than you was somewhere else who was in desperate need of an organ? And her view was, or perspective was, it could be they would just unplug me in order to use my organs elsewhere. This doesn't happen.
No, it certainly doesn't happen at all. No.
But I'm sure people might think that. I'm sure my mum wasn't alone in that.
No, and I'm sure we have people talk to us, and that's why it's important that we discuss it with the families, and the families option is the final option, whether even if the patient says they'd like their organs to be taken, we would always ask the family, and the family's wishes are always final for these reasons. You know, families might not, you know, want the organs taken and things, but I can reassure everybody we would do 100% to try and save that life. And the only time we're going to be withdrawal treatment, we have strict criteria what we would need to follow. And it's not a single person's decision to withdraw treatment. It would be a team decision.
Absolutely.
Do you mind if I just add something
to that?
Please do, yeah. So when I started working in hospitals a long time ago now, my first job was on intensive care. It was my first job as a junior doctor. And I think it's really important to emphasise what a humbling experience it was in terms of seeing the dignity with which individuals were treated, the kindness that was shown to patients, their families and their loved ones, and how that all came together around somebody's the end of somebody's life to create a situation where something good and that gift of organ donation was coming from the process. And I think it really helped shape me and why this is such an important topic to me, as I went through that time working as a doctor and then into thinking at a sort of whole population level about challenges around how our lives end in a way that we would choose and with as much dignity and kindness as possible. And I think the way that it all comes together in those circumstances is one of the most humbling experiences that I've seen as I've worked through my career.
I 100% agree with that. You know, with Daniel, and I say that in all the talks, you know, he was treated with such dignity and kindness and respect. And so were we. You know, we were all looked after. So from being someone that said, But everything that Pam and Matt say, 100% agree.
Mm. And Diane Parker, you've been listening to all this, and we've been hearing the process and receiving the organs, how the actual process works, the clinical side. As your work as a grief counsellor, it's also a crucial part of this because, as we've been saying, this involves the two big ones, life and death. It's what life's all about. We live and then we die, and the juxtaposition is always a very emotional time. Where do you actually come into this picture then? Because, again, people need to, at the same time as making this decision, it's sort of managing their emotions and their grief and their bereavement.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is a very personal journey for me as well. 100% on the team, even though it didn't happen for us. He died. But the team around us at the time in Liverpool were absolutely fabulous. And that just has to be put out there.
Your husband was waiting for a donation, but this is something for you. It didn't actually happen.
That's right, yes. We were 9 months waiting for hopefully the opportunity to get the liver transplant done. We had been over to see the transplant nurse, so everything looked like it was going through. So she sat and talked us through what would happen and where it would be. The team at the Royal were phoning up different hospitals, and it looked like it was actually London that was going to take him on. And so we'd had that appointment and everything looked tickety-boo. We were heading down that way. We went off and had a little break down the south of England, and then when we came back, we were swimming at the time. We both did triathlon. And so we were all getting sort of mentally geared up for races and things that might be happening. And we used to go and swim train together, and he was just like swimming down the pool, and I'm like, he's not going to make it. And even the lifeguards were starting to stand up on their feet. When he come out, he said, I've just got this awful pain in my back. So it was still there the next morning. So I took him to the doctor, and he said, you've either got pneumonia in your in your lungs, or there's blood going into your lungs. So that's what was actually happening, because he was a hemophiliac. So the next thing is, we're flown over to Liverpool, and the hemophilia team were brilliant. They came round, settled all of that down, and the next thing is, they're making phone calls to try and get us shipped off down to London. And then sadly I got told that he had cancer, and it had gone into his lungs. That's what was happening. The hemophilia side, it all settled down. And that's when we got told that it wasn't going to happen. Yeah.
And is this, I mean, is your work now as a grief counsellor, has this your own personal experience? Does this help with
your
work?
Well, I've been
now
coaching since 2004. Hmm. But yes, the experience I had with that, and then 3 months later, my little sister was told that she had cancer, and we went down the journey again with her because she'd had it prior. And I just said to my colleague, Di Lewis, if there's not anything for this, we need to put a programme together, because I'd never felt pain like it. I've dealt with other relatives dying, but not my actual husband. So something that was in part of my immediate family, I suppose, is what you would say, isn't mm-hmm. it, really? And so it was just a case of, finding something, and we found this grief training, so we put that together. And in the training, they just had you look at all losses, but there was no coaching. And you're opening up to an awful lot of stuff that you might be carrying. And we're like, no, we need to put these two together. So grief coaching is what I do. I support people in understanding, first and foremost, grief as an emotion, not a process, and how we store stuff and how we can embrace these things actually when they come up, instead of pushing them down inside, or, oh, I'm not going to speak about that, or don't talk to her about that.
No, and that's the common reaction.
There's nothing worse than somebody that's lost somebody and there's no conversation about them. It's like nobody talks about them at all. That hurts. So,
and of course, again, as you hinted earlier on, the thing I think with grief or whatever, it is unique to the individual. You
know, it is.
Everyone deals with
it. It is, and yet we're all taught to compare. You know, and you sit with other widows, well, how long have you been a widow and how long have you been a widow? Doesn't matter. But coming back to all of this and what this is about, it's about having these conversations before anything happens. We go around in this bubble thinking nothing's going to happen to us. And it's not just about transplants, about, you know, what do your wishes when you die anyway? People don't tend to talk about that kind of thing. Because I think an awful lot of people have brought up to believe it's a process you go through, grief in itself, and it's not. It's an emotion. And we grieve for every loss we experience. So it's the loss of an organ. That is a loss of a life, an obvious one, because that's, we understand that. But it can be something like a job, if you lose a job or something like that. But for today's topic, it's about having those conversations and letting your family know that this is your wishes, this is what you want to have happen. And I believe at the moment, even if you say this is what you want to have happen, the family can, if they don't know, can turn around and say, well, yeah, we don't want that. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what we need to get over in this this talk that we're doing, because you've already decided that this is what you want to give somebody, the gift of life after your death. It's very important to not have a relative in the throes of grief, because you're dying in front of them or whatever, to then have to sit and be approached by a member of staff to say, oh, by the way, we would like to have the organs donated if that's okay with you. This is what the wishes were. You yourself are in a bubble, because the body's gone into protection for you. You've got dopamine coming down, epinephrine, and a bit of serotonin. And you literally are in another bubble to everybody else. Like, everybody else is going on around you and they're trying to ask you these important questions, and you are trying to come to terms with the fact that the person that you've loved is now dying. So I think if we can really emphasise the point of actually having these conversations now, before we get to that stage that you're faced with these things.
I'll just pop in, my donor and his partner had the conversation. Yeah. She knew the minute she was approached, the answer was yes.
Yeah.
Because they'd had the conversation.
Yeah.
They were both bikers, so I don't know if that had any bearing on it. Possibly.
Yeah.
But they were both bikers and they'd actually had the conversation. So when she was approached, instant answer was yes.
Mm.
So you know, he wanted to do everything.
Honouring his final wishes.
Yes, very much right. So.
And that's, I mean, I was sitting there, you know, you were talking about guilt on the other side, and I'm sitting there with guilt thinking somebody has to die for him to get a liver.
For sure, yeah.
And it would have been not just getting the liver for the issues he had, he was a haemophiliac, so it would have changed his life.
Yeah, for sure.
For, you know, we would have conversations, well, what's that going to be like? And he was very sportsman. He loved doing triathlons and things. And on the way up to see the staff, there was posters on the wall. They were running the transplant games.
Right.
So yeah. I was there you go, love, there's your next race. That's what we'll put you in. So we had something to stretch and look forward to. But sadly, when the doctors came in to tell me that it wasn't going to happen, cancer had actually got in there at that point, and it had spread up to his lungs. And I said to him, well, don't you do lung transplants as well? And he went, only with hearts. And I went, well, you know, be a pioneer, do it with the liver as well. That's the extent you want to have your loved one stay with you, obviously. Sure. But I mean, I've just in awe of your stories, absolutely in awe. I do hope that people will think really, really hard about this now and face these conversations with their families. What do you want to have happen?
And as you say, that's the hardest challenge in a way, is getting people to have these discussions in advance. Because I suppose, like so many things, it's not an easy conversation.
Nobody wants to talk about grief.
No, some people always, you know, put it off.
But like you were saying before, how you actually approach somebody that's been bereft by somebody.
Yeah.
You know, to just walk up and say, "I'm so sorry for your loss."
And that's a difficult thing to do for a lot of people, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because they don't know to do it.
Yeah.
But if you've lost somebody and you see somebody crossing the road away from you to avoid a conversation, that hurts. Mm. So, you know, even if you just walk up and say, "I'm so sorry for your loss. Do you want a hug?" That's usually my next line.
Di was the one that kind of helped me with that one. Yeah. Because she always says to me, she loves it when people talk about Daniel.
Yes.
Don't you?
Absolutely.
Especially his friends and things.
Yeah.
So
it's just the best because, you know, they haven't gone. And I think that's what's helped me the last 18 years.
Being able to talk.
Yes. Yeah. But like you say, there's no end to this for me till I die, because it's you don't get over it.
The people we love and lost, they're always in our hearts.
So there's no...
There is no, that's it. No. I should be over this. My father said that to me about my sister, because she died the year after me. Husband, and you know, he said, you know, I should be over this by now, and it's your daughter.
People don't get it.
You're never gonna be over. We find a new way of living our lives without them physically with us, but they're always going to be in our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the first time I actually met Di was when Daniel came into intensive care at Nobles, and I met Di and Daniel's dad at that time, and then arranged the transfer across to Children's Bentley Hospital. So, and then the next time I met Di was when she was doing the campaign for organ donation for the garden, and she joined the organ donation committee on the island. So it's a full circle here.
Yeah, and it's not just about, you know, organ donation on demand isn't just about promotion and education. It's about helping people like myself, you know, on the donor families and also, you know, transplant recipient families now. Because we understand that we're all on this journey now, anyone that's part of it, and we can help each other. Because, like you say, grief, it doesn't just end after a certain period. It's with you. And, you know, certain circumstances, my mum is very ill at the moment, and she's 91, and though I dread that she is going to go, but I can say, you know, at 91, she's had a really good life. But when you're grieving for someone from... I was 38 when Daniel died. And I've got this now until I go. So there's different types of grief, but it never leaves you. So
it's all unique to us.
Yeah, so it's just
journey.
For, you know, the charity isn't just about promotion. It's about talking to people. It's about helping people, and you know, in whatever they need, because we're going to start some official counselling through the committee, and the charity's doing something sort of similar to help people.
We've noticed that we don't actually have like any support groups on the island for donors or for transplant people. So that's something, you know, we've been talking about bringing, you know, trying to set up on the island. So we probably feel that they need to be two separate groups initially.
One to either side, is it?
Yes, definitely, because there is a lot of grief, different types of grief going on there, and we need to work with them. But we do know that both sides of families, whether somebody's lost somebody and they've actually agreed to donate their organs, give the gift of life, do you know that it's normally come from quite a traumatic situation, quite a tragic situation. So they actually quite often need counselling to support them through that, you know, from through the grief as well. And on the other side, when somebody's had a transplant, is that survivor's guilt feeling, and they need some, you know, specialist support from that. And that's something like we're not really trained as such for doing. So we're looking at setting something up on the island, because there isn't that there for people. And part of it can be down to cost. So we've been doing some charity events, raising some money. So we've got monies around to actually start to set up some groups on the island. So if anybody, I'm just going to say, if anybody wants to help us, we'd be more than grateful if they want to get in touch.
Where would be the best place to get in touch?
We've got Organ Donation Isle of Man Facebook page, but we've also got the website, which is organdonationiom.com, and you can, there's contact numbers on there, and everything's in the strictest of confidence. And depending on what help you need, as to we can help you, point you in that right direction, whether it's meeting up with another donor family or another recipient, and we, you know, we can go from there. We're looking at different options off sort of counsellors. We're also going to be working with Walking for Wellness by Gary Thomas. And so we're looking at different ways that people can just come and talk to somebody, maybe not in first of all in a sort of counselling situation, but just with people that understand. And if we can't help within the team, then we will find someone that can, and we're looking at helping people, you know, sort of helping towards the cost of that, because we know that everybody who has either lost somebody and they've donated their organs, or they're a recipient, that there is so many different scenarios of what help they will need.
Or want.
Mm. Yeah.
We're quite a big team, diverse, because we've got so many of us with different experiences.
Yeah. I leaned very heavily on my coaching community to get to help me when I got back home. Mm-hmm. Because obviously I had to come back, because the people only come back every so often from the UK, so I had to come back first on my own without him. So I had a great team of my coaching friends around me to support me, and it's important. And you're right, there was no counselling for him beforehand. It was just the appointments and talking to the staff, which were excellent, by the way, but you're right, there was no guidance.
Maybe it's
just
something
what we were doing for him,
yeah.
with our experience,
you know,
really.
Sort of coming back as a recipient, there was nothing.
Mm.
I've not seen a cardiologist over here since my transplant.
Yeah.
And you'd
so
kind
this
of
is
think
really
that would
good
be
that you're doing
thing.
This because yeah. then you're going to have a pool of people that are no longer going to feel like they're on their own.
But maybe we need to look at the other side, and I have met with, you know, sort of three or four people who, like yourself, the transplant wasn't able to happen, and that is the third side to that,
yeah,
and that we need to, you know, the charity needs to look at as well. Yeah.
Well, I've also just recently started the grief cafes that I'm slowly putting out around the island, just so people can come and talk about their loved one, because sometimes your friends and family just have had enough and you just still want to say their name, talk about them. But also for other losses, obviously. In my case, it's to explain other losses, because understanding grief, I think, is something we all need to really do, and it should be taught in schools, but that's another topic for another day.
Is that something that your work is actually helping people understand, as you say,
understand
their grief and their emotions?
Most people are taught it's a process you go through. Mm. Process implies there's going to be a start, middle and end. So when something is triggered further down the line and you think, what's wrong with me? I should be over this by now, as in case in point my dad said. There's nothing wrong with you. You are grieving. You've been triggered by a memory and it's popped up. What do you need to do? Do you need to grieve and cry? Do you need to do this to the heavens? Sorry, I'm shaking my hand. To the heavens. Or do you just smile and say, thank you for bringing that memory up? And even that can trigger your tears, can't it?
I always think now, back in the Victorian times, they had a period of mourning.
Yeah.
And now that, you know, that's gone.
Yeah.
And then within a couple of days, people are looking at you, not saying it, but kind of thinking, right, well, you know, it's time to get on. Because as the years have gone on, you know, in society, people it's expected that you understand that people die, and so just, you know, get on. And I have always said, you know, there should be, almost like the Victorian time, that period of mourning to actually have time that you don't have to think about anything else. You know, with Daniel, it's 18 years, but somebody said to me recently, but you seem all right. But that's because, of course, I have to seem all right. I can't go around.
We found a way of living our lives without them physically.
Yeah, it's a new way of living.
But then the amount of talks that we've done recently to the student nurses, and you'll find one in the corner in absolute tears, and it's usually because they knew Daniel, wasn't it?
Mm.
There always seems to be one student nurse that knew him. And, you know, it's still affecting them.
Yeah.
18 years down the road.
So when you understand that you've been triggered by emotion and the thing you want to do is cry, there's nothing wrong with that. Don't push stuff down inside for the lid to come off the box later on. I mean, when we initially have them, you know, like I've mentioned, you've got all those chemicals coming on in your own body. And, you know, you have pockets of clarity where, you know, another times you feel like you can't string a sentence together. And those levels take weeks to come back down again.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that's when the wagon wheel can start falling off people, because they look like they're coping, doing all the necessary paperwork or whatever, or whoever you've got around you. If you can't yourself, get somebody that you trust around you to help you with that. But then, you know, that's about 3 weeks or so later, these levels are right down again, and then the raw emotion comes up. But it's about how also you can work on healing your own heart, because that the pain of loss can actually be picked up on an ECG machine. So it's not something that's in your head, it's literally in your heart.
I suppose it also brings us back kind of around to the importance of having the conversations about end of life.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're speaking specifically about the elements around the Human Tissue Organ Donation Act and the importance of recording your wishes both on the register and having the conversation with your loved ones. But culturally, we struggle to have conversations with one another around what our preferences would be at the end of our lives, on a whole host of factors, not just around what our preferences would be in terms of organ donation. Being able to have those conversations on a more regular basis can be, firstly, incredibly rewarding. You know, the understanding that you can build with somebody by understanding what their preferences are is a really important part of how we build relationships and how we talk about things, because this is part of our lives. But the other bit that goes with it is, if we're more comfortable in talking to our nearest and dearest about some of these topics, it also starts to make it more straightforward to talk to other people who might be feeling those things more acutely, whether they're going through grief, whether somebody is approaching end of life, whether they're having to take tough decisions. It can make it easier to support each other and to support ourselves as we go through those processes.
Well, they will be going through grief when you've got somebody that's approaching end of life.
Absolutely.
As well. You're trying to work, you know, through your own emotions with all of that. So this is why I think you're right. It's important that we have all of these conversations. Like, go home if you haven't tonight and have a conversation about it.
I think the most important thing is saying it's a choice.
Yeah.
And
yes,
it's an individual choice, you know, whether they want to donate their organs or not.
Perhaps we can just remind ourselves then, Matt, again, the change out to the opt-out will be coming in 2026. So, again, we're talking about listeners registering their organ donation decision. So when do they need to do that? How do they do that?
So they can record their decision through NHS Blood and Transplant. So they can go to the website, which Pam will helpfully supply me with a second time.
It's organdonation.nhs.uk.
And people can use that link to record their decision, either positively to opt into organ donation, which will help to support the process now, or should they wish to opt out, that's an option that they can make clear at that stage. And that will, of course, continue to apply as we move from one system to the other. But at any time, anybody can go onto that system, whether we're in opt-in or opt-out, to make a positive decision in either direction.
There are excluded groups, though, Matt, when it comes to donation.
Yes, absolutely. So those excluded groups are those who are under the age of 18, people who lack the mental capacity to understand the new arrangements and take necessary action, visitors to the Isle of Man and those not living here voluntarily, and people who have lived in the Isle of Man for less than 12 months before their death. In those circumstances, it will remain an opt-in system and will be dealt with in the way that it has been up to this point. And I think it's just really important to mention again that the majority of people have registered their decision. We've got about two-thirds of the island who have registered a decision, with the vast majority registering to opt in, which is fantastic. A small number choosing to opt out. But just to put alongside that, the fact that, as has already been mentioned, you're much more likely to be the recipient of a donor than to actually be a donor. And at the moment, as of June 2025, there are 12 people on the Isle of Man who are currently awaiting a transplant.
It's been wonderful talking to you all today. I can only say that Matt, Diane, Nikki, Pam, Diane too. Thank you very much indeed for spending the time to talk to us on the podcast today. It's been a great honour.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.